You push and pull an economy long enough and hard enough, things are going to happen. The trickle-down of the invisible hand on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 7th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin on this Monday with two stories that demonstrate once again that there ain't nothing in this economy that happens in a vacuum. Least of all, as example number one, global trade. Yet another round of U.S.-China trade talks started in Washington today, deputy level to begin with. Then on Thursday, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer will bring his steely resolve to the negotiations. If things go well, great. If not, tariffs are set to go up yet again next week from 25% to 30% on something like $250 billion worth of Chinese imports. Now, if you've lost track of which tariffs are going into effect when and who's retaliating for what and what the levels are going to be, you've got company, especially when new data on this thing is coming out all the time. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going with today's trade war status update.
Way back last year, the U.S. put tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. Then China put tariffs on sorghum. It's a grain we grow a lot of. We tax Chinese metals. China hit our pork and fruits. The trade war marches on and on and on. Sometimes it looks like the U.S. and China are close to a deal.
Today, the market rose and then it sank, and now it's risen again on remarks made by Larry Kudlow, one of the president's advisors.
That's Mary Lovely, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
So I think it's very hard to follow.
It's also hard to know exactly how the trade war is affecting the American economy, but a working paper out today from the National Bureau of Economic Research helps. China's tariffs on the U.S. targeted agricultural products like soybeans. Michael Waugh, an NYU trade professor and the paper's author, says that hurt farmers in certain parts of the country like Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa.
And you see very clearly in the data that areas that are more impacted by Chinese retaliation saw falls in their consumption.
Specifically in how many cars were sold, growth in car sales was about 4% lower in counties hit hardest by tariffs. Waugh says this is probably about uncertainty for farmers.
So I'm there in Iowa, I'm looking out in the future, and what do I think? I was like, man, things look really bad. And it's not because I can't afford the car, I just delayed the purchase.
It's an example of how tariffs affect more than just the industries they target. And unless a deal comes this week, more tariffs are probably on the way. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Story number two in our Everything Has a Knock-On Effect coverage today comes with this observation that we are now in the fourth week of the UAW strike against General Motors. There have been proposals and counterproposals, none of which obviously have satisfied. And the longer this thing goes on, the more costly it gets for workers who aren't getting paychecks and so are spending less around town, for GM, too, and its whole network of suppliers. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the downstream effects of this strike.
In the first 3 weeks of the strike, workers at GM and its suppliers lost over $400 million in wages, and GM lost about $660 million in profits. That's according to estimates by the Anderson Economic Group in East Lansing, Michigan, run by Patrick Anderson.
There's a very good chance that Michigan and parts of Ohio and Ontario will actually have a decline in personal income in this quarter because of this strike and its effects elsewhere in the economy.
At this point, Anderson estimates that lost wages from GM suppliers who've been laid off, furloughed, or had their hours reduced have actually surpassed those of striking workers. The longer the strike goes on, the further down the supply chain it reaches, says Michael Robinette with IHS Markit. The first to be impacted were suppliers of bulky items, like seats that are often made to match cars on the production line. But now,
we're moving into smaller subcomponents such as headlamps and paint and audio systems and the like.
Some suppliers have laid off workers, but labor's tight right now. And Robinette says that labor shortage distinguishes this strike from those in decades past. Suppliers don't want to lose their skilled workers. Bill Adler runs Stripmatic Products in Cleveland, Ohio, which makes parts that go into other parts that go into suspensions and chassis. GM accounts for about 30% of his business. Even so, Adler isn't laying off people because he's already short-staffed. So he's using the strike to build up some inventory.
And then I'm going to say in a week or two, if there's still no settlement, we've got a number of productivity or efficiency projects that I'm going to repurpose our current employees to and, you know, make the best of what we can.
Even with the strike, he's still looking to hire equipment operators. Jobs start at about $15 an hour. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One more thing about the GM strike for the car lovers among you. The Detroit Free Press reports today that the much-anticipated 2020 Corvette Stingray is going to be delayed. It's a big deal. This new one going to be a mid-engine model, but GM can't start building it until it clears out all the 2019 orders, which it is obviously not doing right now. $59,995, by the way, base price for that thing. GM shares today down about a 0.5%, 8% to the downside since the strike started. More broadly, on Wall Street to begin the week, kind of choppy, a little bouncy, down at the bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to do a story now that sits firmly at the intersection of business advantage and the physics of the electromagnetic spectrum. And in a way, obliges one to wonder about the nature of time. The New York Stock Exchange is getting some probably unwanted attention for putting a couple of antennas on the roof of its data center. Antennas that could give companies willing to pay for it faster access to market data. How much faster, you ask? 2/1,000ths of a second. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor explains exactly what's going on here.
What exactly can happen in 2/1,000ths of a second?
Everything happens in 2/1,000ths of a second.
Larry Tabb is founder of Tabb Group, a consulting firm focused on infrastructure.
You know, Trump tweets something and people react, whether it's, you know, starting a trade war with China or resolving a trade war with China. But the first person to see that and react, you know, that reaction can occur, you know, 2/1,000ths of a second after that tweet is launched.
Actually, on Wall Street, it's not a person's reaction. It's an algorithm's reaction to something. But the point is, it doesn't matter if it is 2/1,000ths of a second or 5 minutes. Somebody, some computer, is going to be first. First to place that buy or sell order. First to snag a price before it changes. The first to unload a stock before it tanks.
It's a zero-sum game, so there's only one first person.
Companies, Wall Street firms, brokers, traders, will do a lot and pay a lot to be at the front of the line, like literally physically at the front of the line. They'll get as physically close as possible to where stock trades happen.
Which is why some companies have come here to this grassy median in Mahwah, New Jersey.
People look at the New York Stock Exchange on TV and they think that's where it is, on Wall Street. It's not on Wall Street, right? It's in Mahwah, New Jersey.
Joe Saluzzi is with Temis Trading. Mahwah, New Jersey is where the New York Stock Exchange's data center is, the computers that match up buyers and sellers.
That's where the trades get done. And when the trade happens, it creates market data.
To get that data first, traders and market makers paid to put their servers right up in the data center building, right across the street from where I am. They ran fiber optic cables from those servers under the street to this grassy median and up this pole behind some chain link fence, up to microwave antennas that transmit that data out. That costs them tens of thousands of dollars a month each, all for the chance to be first.
So the bottom line is, it's a speed race.
And now the New York Stock Exchange has done something to upset that race. It has installed its own microwave antennas, two of them, about the size of basketballs, right up on the roof of the data center. Closer to the computers than the private antennas down the street. Closer, which means they're faster than everybody else. 2/1,000ths of a second faster. Again, Joe Saluzzi with Temis Trading.
It's who can get to the data the fastest. And the New York Stock Exchange, as well as all the other major exchanges, figured out that we can sell this speed. They need it, and they have to come to us to get it. And essentially, they're holding them hostage.
In a complaint letter to the SEC, one of the companies on that poll, market-making firm Virtu Financial, said it was worried that the New York Stock Exchange would charge exorbitant fees for access to the new antennas, and that only one company would have the right to use them.
The real fear is whether that then undercuts competition in the trading process.
Chester Spatt is a professor of finance at Carnegie Mellon and former chief economist at the SEC. Not all stock exchanges do this, by the way. They don't all cash in on their monopoly power to control speed. There's one exchange called IEX, for example, that actually slows down its data on purpose. Ronan Ryan is president of IEX.
We purposely injected the 350 microseconds of delay so that we didn't have to play in this arms race.
That, FYI, is 175 times longer than this two-millionths of a second business at the New York Stock Exchange everyone's so upset about. Ryan says stock exchanges should make money by, you know, enabling stock trades, not selling access to data.
It's like a referee in the NFL making more money selling stick'em gloves to one of the teams than he makes from being paid to referee the game.
The SEC last year started reviewing fees charged by stock exchanges. It wouldn't comment for this story, nor would the New York Stock Exchange, nor would the firm that complained to the SEC, Virtue Financial. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There was a noteworthy announcement from what was once the iconic American company. Today, General Electric says it's going to freeze pensions for 20,000 non-union workers and is going to offer pension buyouts for another 100,000 former employees. The company says it'll save $8 billion in the process, part of a plan to reduce some of its considerable debt. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports that today's news is just one more step in the long march toward extinction of the once common benefits of pensions in the private sector.
The idea of a pension or a defined benefit plan sounds near mythical to many workers today. A predictable retirement check for a steady amount coming every month for the rest of your life. It's what keeps Janet Horvath working as a manager in a hospital in Atlanta.
I feel very fortunate. Out of the major hospitals that are here in this area, I believe we're maybe one of two or three that still offer it.
And across the private sector, it's even more rare.
Today, it's less than one in five have defined benefit coverage.
James Paterba is an economist at MIT. He says 40 years ago, more than two-thirds of private sector workers with retirement benefits got pensions. But starting in the 1980s, companies began to switch to the now common 401k model, where instead of shouldering the whole retirement plan, they simply make a contribution toward it.
It has shifted a lot of the decision making, and it shifted the risk of the investment returns from the firm to the individual.
Elizabeth Kennedy, a professor of law at Loyola University in Maryland, says there are still some industries where pensions remain, mostly in those dominated by unions. But as membership has declined, so have pensions.
So the types of policies that we have in the workplace are definitely predicated upon this idea of there being not so much of that long-term promise we saw in the past.
And that could have big ramifications as generations without pensions move toward retirement. A federal report shows Americans nearing retirement have a median of $100,000 in their retirement accounts, and almost a quarter of Americans have nothing at all. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
We would love to hear from you about pensions, if you have one, how it's working for you, or maybe how it's not working. Marketplace.org is how to get in touch with us. Coming up,
we counted swing sets to determine where we wanted to put a store.
How to build the country's biggest sporting goods retailer. Seriously. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 95 points today, 0.3%, 26,478. The NASDAQ off 26 points, also 0.3%, 79.56. S&P 500 gave back 13 points. That's 0.4% there, 29.38 there. All right, let's see. General Motors, we did. Here you go with Ford down 0.6% today. The automaker announced plans to form a joint venture in India with its Indian rival Mahindra & Mahindra and is going to end most of its independent operations there. Fiat Chrysler gained 0.6% this Monday. Chipmaker NVIDIA clicked up 1.2% after RBC Capital Markets raised the firm's price targets. Improved semiconductor demand from gaming and data centers, apparently. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.55%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable, a new podcast from Marketplace that explores the thing we're always in our feelings over, but don't really know how to talk about. Money. This is a storytelling podcast that digs into things like how someone can feel like an imposter when they move from one socioeconomic class to another, or why so many people lie about what's in their bank account. We'll even teach you how to ask everyone you know about how much they make. But just to be clear, this is not a personal finance podcast. It is a podcast about life and how money messes with it. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whether you're shopping for a kid in Little League or maybe soccer's her thing, or if you're looking for running gear or something for yourself, Dick's Sporting Goods is probably one of the stores that comes to mind. It's one of the biggest sports retailers in the country now. But 35 years ago, when CEO Ed Stack took over from his dad, Dick, it wasn't much more than just a couple of stores. And with size and market power comes great responsibility, which Ed Stack has decided to act on in ways that aren't necessarily friendly to his bottom line. That and more is the subject of Ed Stack's new book. It's How We Play the Game. It's called, Mr. Stack, good to have you on, sir.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You have worked for this company now that you now run for a very, very long time, yeah?
That's a nice way to put it. It has been a really long time.
I mean, you were like six when your dad started you on weekends or something, right? And then you started actually doing work, like when you were like 15 or something.
Well, actually, my mother would drop me off there when I'm the oldest of five kids, and when she had things to do with the other kids, she'd drop me off there, and my father would stick me in the basement when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and I'd have to do little tasks. So, but I can't really say that I was working there at the time. The store was just babysitting me, really. But I actually did start working there when I was 13. I kind of say tongue-in-cheek, I hated every minute of it, and I basically did. And I didn't want anything to do with the business. I had no interest in coming back to the family business. And as I get ready to get out of college, my dad got really quite sick. And so I had to come back in to help in the family business for a while.
Your relationship with your dad was complicated, and I don't want to dig into it too far. Honestly, for me, it was the most interesting part of the book, I'll tell you that. But and others can read it, and I'm sure you've thought about it a lot. But it did occur to me that you had bigger ambitions for Dick's Sporting Goods than your dad did. Is that fair?
Yeah, that would be right. That'd be correct. My dad, when he first started the business, had a few good years and then expanded the business and went out of business. So once he got back into the business and did reasonably well, we never really had a terrific business. It was always, I would say, a season away from going out of business based on the fact that we were always in debt, had too much inventory, not enough inventory. And when I came back into the business and wanted to expand it, that scared the heck out of my father. Because that scar tissue he had from going out of business, it never fully healed. And we had some pretty spirited conversations about what we would do with the business. You know,
I chuckle only because having read the book, I can only imagine what those spirited conversations were like. There was a certain amount of flying by the seat of your pants as you grew this business. And there's an anecdote you share at some point with you and one of your senior associates early-ish on, talking about going around counting swing sets in neighborhoods to figure out where to put a store.
Yeah, that was our elementary real estate strategy.
Yeah.
So we didn't have a research group. We were just a really small company. We only had two stores when we first moved out of Binghamton and went up to Syracuse, and trying to figure out where to go. We wanted to be where all the other retail is, and we would drive through the neighborhoods around the store and look at swing sets. And if there were a lot of swing sets, then we made the assumption there were a lot of kids there. If there were a lot of kids there, they'd want to buy sporting goods, and if they wanted to buy sporting goods, we might be able to do okay. So our first five or six stores outside of Binghamton, we counted swing sets to determine where we wanted to put a store. Not very sophisticated.
No, but look, it worked out all right. I mean, you know, look at the company today, right?
Yeah, it did work out okay, but I can tell you we've moved past the swing set strategy.
fair enough. I want to make a reference now to the subtitle of this book. It is, as I said, it's called How We Play the Game. The subtitle is Build a Business, Take a Stand, and Make a Difference. And I want to talk about the taking a stand thing, and I want to talk about it in reference to guns and the decisions you have made to suspend, withdraw, whatever your framing is, firearms from most Dick's stores. And it revolves around, obviously, there's a story about September 11th and Parkland. Why and how did you come to that decision?
Well, as you read through the book, it wasn't a decision that was just made simply after Parkland. There was a series of episodes around firearms that dated back to, you know, our early days in one of the early stores in Rochester, moved on to 9/11 and then to Sandy Hook and culminated in Parkland. And we just felt that based on what's going on in the country today, primarily with the assault-style rifles, that we needed to stand up and say something. And after Parkland, it had a really emotional response to this. I mean, watching those kids come out of school, crying, emotional. Some of them had just seen some of their friends killed. Listening to those parents talk about how we failed our kids, and I thought, somebody's got to do something about this. Somebody's got to stand up and try to make a change. And as I continued to kind of play that over and over in my mind, I realized, you know what? We need to be the ones that are going to stand up and say something. We were one of the largest firearms dealers in the country. We knew the issues around firearms. And the shooter in Parkland, I found out that we sold him a shotgun a couple of months before he committed the murders in Parkland. And when that happened, I said, enough is enough. You know, the system is broken. And at that point, we said, we need to stand up and say something. We've got an expertise here. We know what's going on. And we have to try to solve this problem.
It cost you money, though, millions and millions of dollars.
Actually, about $250 million in sales, which we anticipated would be just about what it would cost us. And we as a management team and as our board of directors had talked about that, and we were very thoughtful about it. And, we talk about if we had the chance to do it all over again, mm-hmm. we'd do it all over again exactly the same way.
Let me broaden that idea out a little bit. There's a passage, I don't know, toward the end of this book that I'm just going to read, and then I want to ask you about it. You say, every so often comes a moment when you have to stop thinking of your company solely as an engine for making money and broaden your view to consider its role in American life. Do you think, and I don't expect you to speak for all of corporate America, but you're one of the big guys. Do you think American companies think that way?
I think there's more of them beginning to think that way, and you can see that with some of the other companies that have stepped up and made some statements or mm-hmm. changes. And I think that I've said this a number of times. Most people would agree that there's very little leadership coming out of Washington. And the country is thirsting for leadership from someplace. And right now, the majority of the leadership seems to be coming out of the private sector. I'm not sure that's the way it should be, but that's the way it is right now. Because of what's going on in Washington, and we were very happy to stand up and do our part and give our point of view on the gun piece. And as I said, we'd do it all over again.
Ed Stack is the chairman and CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods. His book, it's a part memoir, part how he runs a business. It's called How We Play the Game. Mr. Stack, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There is a whole bunch more to that conversation with Ed Stack about his early days running the company, besides the swing sets, of course, and what has kept him up at night the past 30-something years. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast. There's also an excerpt from the book as well. You can find all the links at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, which won't come as news to those of you listening during your commute. From the Census Bureau, this nugget. In 2018, the average American worker spent 225 hours, more than 9 full days, getting to and from work. Just over 27 minutes one way is what that works out to. Of the It's a Small World note here that has to be said, the Washington Post reporter who wrote the article that I saw about this now works from home. You can hear his story about that in the interview we did about his book, Moving from the Baltimore Suburbs to Way, Way Rural Minnesota. His name is Chris Ingram. The book is called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. You can check it out at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials off 95 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ down 26 points, also 0.3%. S&P 500 fell 13 points, 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.